Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I am Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing the sort of lost Michael Mann film, The Keep, from 1983.
This is our oldest, I guess, deepest cut by a country mile, I should think.
Yeah, I think so.
We do retro selections here and there, but this is as retro as we've yet ventured.
Yeah, I think Hollow Man, a couple episodes ago, was hitherto the earliest we had gone. That's the year 2000. Yeah.
So the first time we ever covered a movie that was not a contemporary release was Friend Request, which was only from 2016, I think.
Right.
And then that was like an outlier. So right. Now we're breaking new ground here on the Shock Doctors Podcast. It's going to be a fucking Nosferatu Faust double feature next week.
Yeah, I mean, you know, now that it used to be that we were just trying to keep up with theatrical releases, and now that those really aren't a thing, we're a little more free to go wherever the hell we
There's
want.
There's a bit in this movie where Ian McKellen is translating like ancient Cyrillic script, and he's like, This language has been dead for 500 years. That's how I felt when you said the phrase theatrical releases. Anyway, The Keep is goofy as all hell, but really sedate at the same time. It's an odd duck.
It's very hard to pin down. A lot of it, although obviously I don't think we can attribute all of its weirdness, but a lot of the weirdness probably comes down to the fact that it had a very troubled production history. Among other things, the special effects
supervisor,
Wally
Weaver,
you said? Yeah, okay.
I will double check that.
Yeah.
And issue a correction if I am wrong.
Yeah, so the special effects supervisor died 2 weeks into post-production.
Yes, sir.
And Michael Mann
and
had to do...
His secrets died with him, apparently. like a medieval alchemist.
He left no plans behind. Michael Mann had to put together like 260 individual special effects shots himself. The film went through a series of dramatically different cuts. Mann's original cut of the film was 3.5 hours long. Then it was abruptly cut down to 2 hours and change. That didn't test well. The studio cut it down again to its final length of 96 minutes. And among other things, that also apparently resulted in some seriously bad sound mixing, which
yes,
we'll get into more later.
It appears to be the one thing that all of the cuts have in common is that they are all mixed for shit. I was glad that we didn't just get our hands on a bum copy. Apparently they all sound like that.
Yeah. So
it's Weavers, apparently.
Oh, Weavers.
Wally Weavers.
Apologies to the Weavers estate.
Yes.
But in any case, we'll just front load this right now. The Keep is a mess, but it's also an interesting mess, as you might expect from a Michael Mann feature. So we're going to attempt to summarize what this movie is about. I don't know that we're going to be 100% successful, because I don't think the movie is 100% successful in establishing what it is supposed to be about.
No, it's like reading... It's like if someone asked you to summarize the Bible and you'd only read fragments of various apocrypha. It really just feels like you're just getting scraps from a much larger kind of tapestry. And I talk about the Bible specifically because the movie is steeped in religious overtones and kind of mythic significance.
Mysticism.
That is totally unjustified in its present form and likely would have still been not totally warranted even in its David Lean-esque form. But, you know, who can say? Michael Mann has gone on record saying that he has no intention of assembling or reassembling the 3.5 hour cut, or indeed any cut other than the one that presently exists, because too many of the elements are too difficult to integrate for whatever reason. I have a feeling that the 3.5 hour cut was very rough in the sense I don't think that they ever at any point had almost 4 hours worth of finished, polished special effects.
Probably
I think that they
not.
Were picking the scenes they wanted to keep and polishing those turds as best they could. So it would be like what Zack Snyder's Justice League probably looked like before HBO threw a bunch of money at it. Just a lot of, I don't know, what a...
The less we talk about the Snyder Cut, the better.
Right, maybe so.
As far as I'm concerned. So, in brief, this film is about a keep in the Carpathian Alps in Romania during the Second World War that is occupied by some German soldiers, and apparently it's haunted. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah, Scott Glenn plays a mysterious interloper who
takes most of the movie to get there.
Right.
I feel like
he just moseys his way to the climax.
Well, he's a traveler.
With no special haste.
Yeah.
No undue haste.
And yeah, it gets steadily more off the rails from there. Yes. So
we open with shots that would be right at home in William Friedkin's Sorcerer. We've got a truck moving through a jungle, a lot of green trees swaying in the breeze, misty mountains. And then we pan down from the tree line, and the truck is this sort of military jeep is moving through a rustic village. And
it's the village from Dracula. It's the village like down the mountain from Castle Dracula.
You made that joke out loud, and then right on cue, the fucking Carpathian Alps, Romania comes up on screen, and there you have it. I mean, my notes say the same thing. My notes actually say left Budapest this morning, which is a reference to, left Budapest this morning. That's Keanu and internet darling Keanu Reeves in Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula. Actually, it looks less like a village from Coppola's Dracula and more like the Herzog remake of Nosferatu with all the mist hanging over everything. It looks very much like a Herzog film of that era, or earlier, actually. I would say like late 70s vintage. He has a movie called Heart of Glass, which I adore, which is also very similar in style to this movie's environs. So they move from the village into the keep, the titular keep, which is a foreboding structure. It's inlaid with all of these gleaming crucifixes, foot long or so, that stud the wall periodically. There's 108 of them,
yeah,
supposedly. And some sort of resident holy man is being grilled by a German captain played by Jürgen Prochnow. I think he's a captain.
Yeah, fresh off of Das Boot.
Yes. There's some talk about, oh, the crosses are all made of nickel, but maybe they want to find out if they're valuable. The keep is not to be trifled with. The villagers are all afraid of it. The locals all steer clear of it at night. Not because it's haunted, just because it's bad juju. The guy will not specify.
Yeah, he's not a local holy man. He's the caretaker, apparently.
Well, he has everyone in this town looks like they could be a shaman.
Well, that's fair. Yeah, no, he's like, yeah, my father before me, his whole life took care of this place, and his father before him, and so on, and after I die, my sons...
The way he talks
about
it makes it sound like he is maybe has some rites that he's keeping up with in order to, you know, circles of salt and so
we
on.
We do what needs to be done.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He says that verbatim, that line.
Yeah. So he and his sons fuck off. And
never to be seen again, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, no, never to be seen again.
In this version of the movie.
Right. I mean, they could have like 45 minutes of screen time in the original cut. Who knows?
A whole subplot.
So Jürgen and his troops are left all alone.
Two of his grunts find the one cross set into the wall that's made of silver rather than nickel. So they pry it off.
It's glowing.
Yes. It looks like radioactive. It looks like something you would kill Superman with.
One of them, there's this like hole behind the cross that seems to be like leading to another room. He goes in and then he like slides down this shaft.
Mm-hmm. Like a chute of some kind, and emerges. He's dangling by his ankles. His friend is holding onto the other end of this tether, and he finds himself dangling in this antechamber, this cavernous subterranean.
Enormous void.
Yeah, it looks like it's a cool shot. It starts relatively tight on him and then zooms way the hell out. It looks like a landscape you'd find on LV-426.
Yeah, that's apt. his friend manages to pull him back out, and then something appears and makes them both explode into fragments of their skeletons.
Yeah, this holy sort of Spielbergian light emanates from the crevice, and yeah, they both are disintegrated. One of them ragdolls against the wall in a very pleasing fashion. In that classic 80s action movie way where you can tell that it's a mannequin, but somehow that just adds to the joy. It's great because this is not a movie. This is a movie that bides its time a lot of the time, almost its entire runtime, but it does kick off. It does not wait until the third act to open the Ark of the Covenant. Let me put it that way.
Right.
The unquiet spirits come out to start immolating Nazis pretty much right from the jump. We're now introduced to Scott Glenn. I think right after the ragdoll collapses to the floor, he wakes up in a room somewhere. He's very stoic.
He's also, he wakes up with his eyes glowing.
Yes.
And also this like sparkly aura around his lower torso.
So he's a celestial being of some kind. And in fact, the way the cut happens, and this is probably Paramount butchery, which this movie is replete with, supposedly. The way that the cut happens, it almost seemed to me before I recognized, oh, that's Jack Crawford. it seemed to me like one or both of the Nazis had been Solarised into a dreamscape of some kind. You know, that they'd materialized in some kind of weird hallucinogenic mind palace situation. They're just toast. That's not what's happening at all. But the cut is very jarring. You know, you see him with his glowing eyes and his aura, and you just kind of don't know what you're dealing with. Is he an angel? Jury's still out on that one.
Yeah, even after we've watched the whole movie. So don't really know.
Village of the Damned Eyes notwithstanding, he's set up to be a kind of standard macho, taciturn Michael Mann protagonist of this year. I mean, he's like, what's his name in Manhunter, where he says the bare minimum.
Peterson,
yeah. His first line of dialogue after he's been on screen for 2 minutes or more is, I need a boat. Just, he's right. Very matter of fact in a very 80s movie kind of way, and I appreciated that. Yeah, it was actually, I need to hire a boat. Yeah, and then he hires a boat.
He's in Athens and he's trying to get to Romania.
And then there's a quintessentially beautiful Michael Mann shot of him piloting this boat across the Straits of whatever at sunrise, sunset, hard to say. Point is, there's this glowing orange horizon shimmering upon the water. And we linger on it for a really long time. So whoever took their scissors to this movie was not completely... They must have had a little bit of a poet in them, because this shot is completely expendable.
Oh, yeah.
Plot-wise, but is quite lovely to behold, and so I'm glad that it didn't wind up on the cutting room floor.
Yeah. So it's around this time that the SS shows up.
Yes.
In the village.
Gabriel Byrne.
In the form of Gabriel Byrne, playing an SS officer, which is odd. And basically he orders...
And he's like the evil German to Jürgen Prochnow's good German for the rest of the movie, which is doubly strange.
You know, that it's very weird.
Of the two of them, you would expect Jürgen to play the more credible Nazi menace,
I know I invoked Das Boot earlier, but like since then, he's basically made an entire career out of being an evil German.
Right.
So, yeah, it's very strange. Apparently, this was still in his transitional period to German villainy typecasting. But, yeah, so Gabriel Byrne, Sturmbannfuhrer, Kämpfer, or whatever the hell his rank is. I'm fuzzy on those.
Point being, he and his goons all wear swastika armbands. Prochnow's crew does not.
Right.
As far as I can recollect.
Well, that's a very SS thing.
Well, sure, but in movie shorthand, it's like, oh, well, these are the actual
These are the Nazis. Yeah. Those are just Germans.
These are the capital N Nazis.
Right. Anyway, they execute some villagers at random because it's their belief that there are, you know, communist partisans operating out of the village, and they're responsible for the dead Germans as opposed to something supernatural going on. Jürgen attempts to stop this execution and fails and gets upbraided by Gabriel Byrne for doing so. And then upbraided some more later and upbraided pretty much for the rest of the movie. When they appear on screen, which of which there are many gaps.
Uh-huh.
the Germans drop out of the movie for long stretches.
But then who doesn't? I mean, there's a lot of conspicuous absences, and I'm going to talk about that more after the break if I remember to. There's a supernatural element in this movie that also comes and goes willy-nilly, it seems like, at times. There's a boogeyman who could and maybe should be wreaking a lot more havoc and just is faffing about somewhere off-screen for almost the whole duration of the movie. We'll get to that shortly. Point being, my co-host is right. Gabriel Byrne and Jürgen Prochnow's relationship is basically just Gabriel Byrne pulling rank over and over with little variation, which gets old fast. So the movie definitely descends into, diet come-and-see mode for a second with them liquidating the villagers. And then Gabriel Byrne establishes his villain credentials further, his Nazi villain credentials specifically, because he is trying to settle this mystery of who torched these two German soldiers. And he blames, you know, local agitators, partisans, and there's some kind of missive scrawled on the wall above their charred corpses, and he wants it translated. First, he doesn't believe that it's not written in just the local language.
Yeah, he grabs the local priest played by Robert Prosky in a role that I think was supposed to be a lot larger than it ended up being.
Mm-hmm.
Demands that he translate it, and it's like, it looks like Romanian, but it's not Romanian. I don't know what this says.
Yeah, it's gibberish. And then under duress, he name drops a translator, a local-ish intellectual who might be able to parse it for them.
Yeah.
But
Dr. Theodore Kuza, played by Ian McKellen, of all people.
Yes,
this,
indeed.
This cast is improbably stacked, a lot more so than I thought it was going to be before we actually got the movie rolling. So, mm-hmm. But of course, Dr. Kuza is also Jewish, so he is no longer in the area. He has been taken to
Dachau, I think is what they keep saying, which seems to be Gabriel Byrne's stomping ground also. I think Jürgen Prochnow alludes to that at one point. He talks about how he earned his stripes shooting people who actually shot back, not just presiding over a death camp somewhere. So,
I mean, I don't think he necessarily says anything about a death camp. I think he just talks about the SS shooting civilians in general.
Well, yes.
So
yeah.
I don't think it was necessarily at a concentration camp.
He says something about, like, when you go back to Dachau, if you go back to Dachau, you're going to, but then it lapses into semi-audible whispering, like every line in this movie.
Like everything else.
Yeah.
In any case, we are then introduced to Dr. Kuza himself, along with his daughter, Eva, who are at the camp, and then they are retrieved and brought to the keep. And the doctor reads the missive and says something very portentous about it being in a language that hasn't been spoken or written.
For 500 years!
Ian McKellen's voice in this movie is very strange, and we'll talk more about that after the break.
I was doing my best Gandalf there, and that is among his Gandalfier deliveries in the film, but his voice work is all over the shop. It's just all over the damn place. Yes, definitely more on that after the break. So the message says something, something, when the such and such is in the who's a what's it, I will be free. That's the only part that I heard definitively.
The such and such is in the who's a what's it. You heard it here first.
And Jupiter aligns with Mars. Then peace will guide the planets. That's our second Hair reference in as many episodes.
Yep.
Point being, it's an ill omen. It's a prophecy of some kind. Subsequently, Dr. Kuza has been brought here with his daughter. I believe we mentioned that.
Yes. Not,
yeah. And his daughter's named Eva. Is that right?
Eva. Yeah.
Eva. And she is assaulted by two German soldiers. They're attempting to rape her. And then a wave of fog, like a fog cylinder, levitates down the hallway and makes short work of them both. Their heads explode. It looks like ceramic shards. It looks like you dropped a coffee mug.
Well, yeah, first their eyes are like shooting forth with white glowing fog, and then
their souls are sucked out of their eye sockets, and then they get scanners, albeit
without the blood.
Without the viscera, which is a shame.
It's still pretty spectacular to look at, though. Then this fog cylinder, as Matt put it, sort of coalesces into this hot lava / fog golem.
It looks like something the Power Rangers would fight, at least at first blush. And it's one of the most confounding shots I've seen in a long time. The fog beast come lava golem is supposed to be carrying the woman down the hall in a classic Creature from the Black Lagoon kind of pose. But there's so much mist that it just kind of looks like she's moving down a smoke waterfall. I mean, it was really dreamlike, and it almost looked like music video imagery. It was just very slippery. I could not wrap my head around what I was looking at. And then she's deposited at the feet of her father, and he does the standard, "No, take me," thing. You know, "You leave her alone." And then he is touched by the golem.
It makes him young again.
Yeah, it makes him the age that Ian McKellen actually was at the time of filming. It's funny, because when you first see him in Dachau, you think, like, wow, Ian McKellen really was always old. But then, as it so happens, it's a Max von Sydow exorcist situation where they aged him up 30, 40 odd years.
Right. So, at this point, Ian McKellen has basically become the creature's assistant, more or less.
Yeah, he's beholden to it, in a way. He kind of makes a deal with the devil. The creature tells him that he needs some talisman taken from the keep and hidden in the mountains so that he, the monster, can...
go kill Hitler.
Go to Berlin and destroy the Third Reich with his molten lava hands. It's a tempting offer. I myself would have been hemming and hawing in 1940, whatever, presented with this Faustian bargain. Because the monster seems genuinely incensed when McKellen gives him the skinny. He's like, "My people dying? Who has done this?" He's like an enraged genie, like a djinn. And he
looks... he looks like a Titan from Attack on Titan.
Yeah, as he starts to cohere and the mist mercifully subsides, he looks like... I mean, he's stocky. He's got the shape of, like, Swamp Thing, but he's got a bunch of exposed sinew and musculature. It's like if Dave Bautista was flayed alive. That's kind of what it looked like. Or if Dave Bautista underwent the Hollow Man procedure. And it just kind of got arrested.
It stopped after the skin.
Yeah. Right.
So Ian McKellen agrees, and he gets his daughter sent back to the village to stay in the local inn, basically by manipulating Gabriel Byrne.
Very susceptible to reverse psychology, as it turns
exactly.
out.
Exactly. Jürgen's trying to...
"No, don't throw her in the briar patch."
"Ah, very well. I will throw her in the briar patch."
He's not as much of a ham, Gabriel Byrne.
His German accent is not
actually,
so
actually too subdued, if anything.
It mostly just sounds
like Gabriel Byrne a lot of the time when you can actually hear him.
Right. Anyway, she gets sent off to the village where she meets Scott Glenn.
Yes.
And they end up...
having a soft focus, like, Skinamax's tryst with the omnipresent Tangerine Dream score laid on extra thick.
I mean, this scene goes on for 2 or 3 minutes, I feel like. They're getting down.
I talked about how the shot of her on the fog waterfall looked like it was from a music video. I mean, that was just because it was so abstract, I didn't know what I was looking at. This looks like it's from a music video in a much cheaper way. I mean, it looks like it should have a Heart song from this era playing over it. I mean, it looks like... I don't know. It does not look like it's from the 1940s. It looks very much like an 80s love scene. You've seen one, you've seen them all.
Yeah, it looks like...
"These dreams go on when I close my eyes."
It's like... Tom Cruise and Rebecca De Mornay fucking on the train in Risky Business.
Yes.
Which makes sense, because that's also Tangerine Dream.
I remember that being In the Air Tonight playing in that scene.
I don't think so.
Really? I could have sworn there's some Phil Collins going on there.
No, I'm pretty sure it's Tangerine Dream playing.
I need very little incentive to rewatch Risky Business. I'm quite fond of that movie.
Fair.
So we might have to settle this with a gentleman's wager after we're done here.
It's good stuff. In any case, they have this extended love scene, and then...
my favorite line in the movie emerges from this tryst, which is when she says, "Who are you?" And he says, "A traveler." And she says, "From where?" And he says... "From everywhere." Bravo.
In any case,
the two of them rendezvous with Dr. Kuza, is that right? Ian McKellen. He is no longer infirm. He's a young man now, a spry man of whatever age Ian McKellen was.
I mean, he's still gray.
But yeah, and he's pretending to be confined to a wheelchair still because he's supposedly still under Nazi supervision, but they're not keeping a very close eye on him.
There is at least a 20 to 25 minute period in a, as we've said, not super long movie. Also, after they've arrived, which is halfway through the movie, there's a 20 to 25 minute stretch where the Nazis don't appear one goddamn time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and now they also drop off the face of creation, and Ian McKellen is wandering around completely unsupervised, planning to steal this talisman and do the golem's bidding. What the golem is doing while all of this is going on is anybody's guess. He's also totally MIA, despite the fact that he's capable of wreaking a lot of havoc in his present state. I mean, it's not like a Hellraiser situation where he's like slowly constituting himself. He's basically good to go.
Yeah.
Right now. I mean, it's not his final cell transformation, but he's already in good shape. Like I said, he looks like a skinless Dave Bautista.
Yeah.
He's a destroyer of men. But apparently these Nazis operate on the honor system, and Ian McKellen can come and go as he pleases. So he bumps into his daughter and Scott Glenn, the traveler from everywhere, outside of Scott Glenn's cabin. And Scott Glenn's like, nah, man, don't take the talisman out of the keep. That's a really bad idea, actually. The keep is the golem's prison. If you loose him upon the world, it'll be even worse than that there genocide business that's going on. He's not your buddy, basically.
And he says something about how I put the talisman there, basically, right, to keep him trapped.
Right, that was the demon, the golem, says that the talisman is something of his. And Scott Glenn clarifies, no, it does not belong to him.
Belongs to me.
Yes.
So they get into this argument. Meanwhile, we finally do see the Nazis again.
Yes. They all wake up from their Sleeping Beauty slumber simultaneously. They all come out of hibernation.
Gabriel Byrne and Jürgen Prochnow get into yet another argument where Byrne castigates Prochnow for his sentimentality. Don't lecture me about real fighting and this and that. And it culminates with Gabriel Byrne shooting him.
Yes.
For reasons passing understanding, beyond just their basic antipathy, but it's still, I don't know why he decides now to just fucking shoot him in the back.
It's possible that Prochnow issued some kind of ultimatum unheard by you or I, because a lot of their final altercation is
completely fucking inaudible.
Completely inaudible. I mean, he at one point, like, very emphatically, like, pokes him in the chest and says, it's if it weren't for the goddamn Tangerine Dream music, you would think the audio had cut out.
Yes.
And yeah, so then he shoots him. The world may never know why. Yeah, other than establishing his Nazi villain credentials for the umpteenth time. So then a gaggle of Nazis, a troop of Nazis surround Scott Glenn's abode. And what transpires? They wind up shooting him.
Well, they bust in and they drag him out and they're going to take him to the keep. And basically, he won't go, or he won't fork over his luggage, which contains like a lightsaber, basically.
Have we seen it up till now?
We've seen the case.
We've seen the case, which looks like he's carrying a pool cue with him. I mean, he looks like Tom Cruise in Color of Money.
Right. And we later find out it's basically a lightsaber. But he doesn't want to fork it over. He kind of resists, but only a little. And then they shoot him. And
well, it's because Ava runs out and tries to be with him. The men in this movie, the male protagonists, are perpetually trying to get her out of harm's way. And she keeps inserting herself into harm's way. And so that's when it escalates. He gets shot in the chest repeatedly.
It bleeds phosphorescent green
blood. He looks like a broken glow stick. And then he, yeah, collapses in a heap.
What, he falls into... Oh!
But not
right.
Before.
No, he hurls a Nazi.
Who lets out a goofy yell. I mean, it sounds that silly. If it had been a style, it's sillier than a Wilhelm scream.
Yes.
But, or an order of magnitude.
Or a Howie scream, yes, for that matter. Yeah. So that's what prompts the shooting. He tosses a Nazi into the canyon.
With, like, one hand, the ravine, like, bodily through the air. He goes arcing like a football.
And then Scott Glenn falls into the same chasm. We later find out he lands on a ledge because he has to crawl back out later.
Inexorably.
Gabriel Byrne hears a commotion from another place inside the keep, and he comes out and he finds all of his soldiers basically have been Ark of the Covenanted.
Yeah, he finds the smoldering remnants of what would have been the highlight of this movie had they known how to do the special effects. I mean, there's absolutely no way that scene would have wound up on the cutting room floor if their special effects supervisor hadn't kicked the bucket when he did. Yeah, it's a damn shame. Since I lauded this movie for kicking off with a lot of good Ark of the Covenant business, and then, yeah, it's elided when it would have supplied the movie with an actual climax.
The golem appears, and he has achieved full dark side / the creatures from Prometheus. Big red glowing eyes and mouth.
Yeah,
and
he's
then
got
just
like a
weird, like,
hard magma carapace now, like an exoskeleton.
And he kills Gabriel Byrne, basically.
Yeah, rather anticlimactically. They don't even, especially relative to how much fucking banter Gabriel Byrne exchanges with Jürgen Prochnow, they really don't. They hardly say a word to each other.
Yeah.
And then he just wrecks his shit. So we're in danger of slipping off into tangerine dreamland over here. It's getting late. Point being, Scott Glenn shows up with his lightsaber. Ian McKellen is in the mix. He's got the talisman. The talisman, by the way, looks like a flashlight with dorsal fins. I mean, it literally does just look like a Home Depot flashlight. It's got like a bulb on the top and little... It looks like a cross with a light bulb on it. And it looks remarkably cheap looking for how kind of ostentatious the rest of the movie is in terms of set design and what have you, special effects. So the golem instructs Ian McKellen to murder his own daughter because she's obstructing his escape. And Ian McKellen finds his conscience. The golem re-withers him. puts all the wrinkles back where they used to be. Unirons him out. And then Scott Glenn shows up, grabs the talisman, affixes it to the end of his pool cue, and then does battle.
And then he's a-firing his laser.
Yes, pew-pew. He, like, shoots the golem through the chest, and then the golem gets sucked into a white void.
Inside the keep, yeah.
Portal. And then Scott Glenn is also dragged into the portal.
For reasons passing understanding.
Yeah, apparently there was a happy ending where he reemerges, but that got scrapped for time. The first only time I've ever heard of a studio scrapping the happy ending. Usually the studio mandates a happy ending where one would not have been appropriate.
Right.
Here they clearly just could not have given less of a shit what this movie looked like. Ava has like a Godfather 3 Al Pacino scream.
Mm-hmm.
That's but then again, so much of this movie is inaudible. Maybe that was a mistake. Maybe you were supposed to hear it. Her posture's all wrong, too. She's, like, really rigid, and she just kind of opens her mouth, like, but it's, like, it's hard to imagine.
Anyway,
so there's just no real passion in it. And then she slumps to the ground and kind of cradles her father. And I think that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, no. Roll fucking credits.
A Michael Mann film. I'm surprised it wasn't an Alan Smithy joint after all they put him through.
Michael Mann's too stubborn, I think.
Yeah.
He's like, I disavow this movie, but this is my fucking movie.
God damn it. That shot of the boat.
I did that.
Is an 11 out of 10.
Fuck you.
I'll take that to my grave.
Well, anyway, we're going to go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with some thoughts about Ian McKellen's voice work and everything else.
This place was not built to keep anything out. This place was built to keep something in. You must not stay here.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Something has been released.
Something.
Did you find what you were looking for? Did you expect to find me?
What are you? Whatever kills us gets in anyway. Nothing we do, no security works.
What's happening to me?
And we're back. So, Matt, do you want to talk about it or should I talk about it?
I thought that there were times... You said Walter Matthau, I believe.
I did.
Where Ian McKellen sounds a bit like Walter Matthau, and I heard that too. But what I heard chiefly, and it did come and go because the voice is all over the place. So he seems to be striving for an American accent.
Which also doesn't make sense.
No, it makes less sense. People in movies like this always affect British accents to play anyone in Europe, anywhere. In Europe. I mean, it's...
And Ian McKellen already has one. A rather nice one. So why didn't he just stick with that?
Right. Yeah, it's very puzzling. His whole presence in this movie reminded me of Patrick Stewart's turn in Life Force.
Life Force, yeah.
I thought about that over and over. It's like, you don't know what you are yet, Patrick Stewart or Ian McKellen, but you might not know this, but you're slumming it. And future generations will look back on this and find it hard to compute. which I did. And his voice was hardest to compute of all. To me, he sounded occasionally a little bit like Richard Nixon. And this came out most prominently when the golem is threatening to turn him into a pile of ash, you know, as he does. Because he accuses him, oh, you're collaborating with the enemy. And Ian McKellen, I swear to God, goes, don't accuse me of collaborating. does everything except flash a peace sign. And it's confounding. I mean, it's just utterly confounding. And then you said Walter Matthau, and I thought, God damn, Walter Matthau would have made a great Nixon. That's a...
Oh, man.
Fucking travesty that never happened.
That's a shame.
Like around Watergate era, I mean, he would have been the right age, you know?
Yeah.
It would have been perfect.
Damn.
What might have been? I mean, that's the keep all over, what might have been.
Yeah. I want to know what a 3.5-hour cut of this movie would have looked like with all the special effects as they were meant to have been.
Mm-hmm.
And also with proper sound mixing.
# release the man cut.
The problem is, I'm sure it never existed.
Right.
Just like I suspect the Snyder Cut, it didn't properly exist.
No, yeah, and like I said, until HBO threw a shitload of money at it.
Right. But it's entirely possible that the full director's vision mind cut still wouldn't have been entirely coherent. But I gotta fucking believe, this movie is impossible to follow.
I don't think they ever say Scott Glenn's character's name out loud.
And what is it again?
I'm glad you asked.
Run that by us.
Scott Glenn plays a character named Glaken Trismegis. No, hold on. Keep that flub. This is important. Scott Glenn plays a character named Glaken Trismegistus. It sounds like the word that James Lipton makes up in that SNL sketch.
Glaken Scrum Trilescent.
It's so Trismegistus, I can hardly move.
Yeah.
So no one, if anyone said that out loud, believe me, I would remember it. Unless I couldn't hear them, which is very possible.
Very possible. So it's entirely possible that this movie, even at 3.5 hours, would have been gibberish, but there have to be so many things missing. I mean, number one, Robert Prosky, not a huge name, obviously. He's rooted in my brain mostly because he's got a semi-large supporting role in Last Action Hero and also Mrs. Doubtfire. two movies from the early to mid 90s that are big parts of my childhood.
Right.
So I remember him for that reason. But, you know, he was a relatively noteworthy character actor, and they made him this priest who has one scene that we didn't really talk about. He's like old friends with Ian McKellen's character, and they get in this like theological argument. And it would have made so much more sense if he was more of a character. But instead, he's got like, other than this, he's got like maybe 2 minutes of screen time. And then he just shows up for 3 minutes to scream at Ian McKellen about God and the devil.
Yeah. And then, he occasionally tries to intercede on the behalf of villagers who wind up getting put in front of a firing squad. Pretty thankless role.
Yeah. I imagine that
the caretaker probably had more to do. We said as much even during the plot rundown.
The Nazis probably would have been doing more. I mean, we, as I said, from like minute 47 to minute 73, they're just completely fucking absent.
Yeah, I mean, it really does feel like they wink out of existence. And I have to believe there was a sequence cut that showed how Ian McKellen splinter-celled his way out of the keep in a wheelchair when he's getting up to mischief looking for the talisman and
no,
all that.
No, you see, he rolled up to Gabriel Byrne and said, I can't be allowed to leave the keep.
Your shoe's untied. What? Mein shoe?
They just, it turns out the rest of the 3.5 hours was just wacky hijinks involving Ian McKellen and this cartoon Nazi.
Hogan's hero shit. Yeah. So there's just so much that clearly has to be missing from this movie that it's really kind of hard to pass judgment on what it was supposed to have been. So I guess we just have to judge the movie as it exists. And frankly, although it's very pretty to look at, big surprise, it's Michael Mann. And occasionally there are interesting things that happen. Overall, it's not great.
Well, we talked about this even before we started recording. What I find most perplexing about this movie is that they hacked it down from 210 minutes to 2 hours, which is the contractually obligated runtime. So that was the cap. So they kept it at 2 hours. That didn't go over well with test audiences. So then they hacked almost a half an hour out of it. And what we're left with is still glacially paced. It's like they kept all of the most languorous scenes, which is not how studios operate. They would have tried to trim the fat, and the fat is everything that's still on screen, I would think. So I think it's possible that the 3.5 hour cut was just more of the same. I mean, that beggars belief, but I can't imagine them discarding a really plot-heavy scene in favor of keeping Scott Glenn wandering around being stoic and mysterious for 2.5 minutes and not talking to anyone.
Yeah.
It's very puzzling.
You would think, but who knows?
Maybe there was just no one at the wheel.
They churned through like 6 editors.
Could be.
Just like, all right, we want you to cut together this 20-minute segment from this hour of footage.
Yeah, maybe they got their wires crossed, and the cut that we wound up with was like the 96 minutes that was supposed to be discarded. Just strung together haphazardly.
All right. Print it.
Yeah, cross our fingers and say a prayer. Yeah, there's just all kinds of oddities in it. One weird thing for Michael Mann, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in it that's quintessentially Michael Mann, which we've been quick to point out. But one thing that is very unlike him is that a lot of the slow-mo looks like it was not meditated upon and was just done in post. I mean, a lot of the slow-mo in the movie looks very erratic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it'll happen for just a few frames and then it comes and goes. It's something that occasionally looks like it was baked into the movie from its inception, but more often looks like it was applied, like I said, in post to cover up some editing kerfuffle or just try to inject style into the movie where there otherwise would not have been. It's an unholy mess. The Tangerine Dream score turns into a little bit of a tangerine nightmare at points. I mean, it drowns out a lot of the dialogue, as we've said, and there's an extended riff near the end, and I think this does vary from cut to cut. Part of the reason you said that this has never been released on DVD is that they don't have the rights to the soundtrack anymore. So it's possible, and I think that there are versions floating around that have the original music, some that don't. I don't know which one we saw. whichever version we got our hands on, there's a bit in the lead up to the climax where nothing much is happening. Ian McKellen has the talisman. He's walking around. Ava is walking around. Scott Glenn is walking around with his pool cue lightsaber, whatchamacallit. And they're all walking towards each other, we infer. I mean, it's not actually spatially established. But and the music sounds like it's trying to rewind itself as it's playing. It has this weird, like, it's I mean, that makes it sound more like a Trap House remix or something. It's not that. It's just, I don't know. I really like Thief. The Tangerine Dream music in Thief didn't bother me at all. I find Tangerine Dream a little obnoxious at the best of times, and in this movie, especially so. I think they did Sorcerer as well, and I don't remember that getting on my nerves. Maybe I don't give Tangerine Dream enough credit, but when they grate on me, they truly grate on me. Do you remember watching that silent Dante's Inferno movie with the Tangerine Dream score that we had to mute? Because it was nails on a chalkboard.
I mean,
it was just obtrusive.
Well,
especially
yeah.
in a silent movie where there's nothing else on the soundscape.
Well, yeah, that's not Tangerine Dream's fault. That's the fault of the asshole who thought it was a good idea to pick Tangerine Dream to score L'Inferno.
Yeah.
Like, it's just stupid.
Right.
Yes, Tangerine Dream did do the soundtrack for Sorcerer.
All right, yeah, and I remember that being rather good. I mean, I likened the opening of this movie to Sorcerer as a favorable comparison. I think that this movie had a little more Sorcerer in it. It probably would have done it some good. What it wound up reminding me of more than anything was, oh, I don't know, David Lynch's Dune or Legend, maybe. Or I actually like John Boorman's Excalibur for the most part, but it reminded me of Excalibur. Any of those movies I just rattled off, big, cheesy 80s follies. Productions that just got way out of hand and then got mangled by studio interference. It just movies with unrealizable potential from this era are kind of all the same flavor of overblown schlock. And I think The Keep is in keeping with that grand tradition. I mean, it reminded me of Dune, Excalibur, whatever the other movie, Legend. It's a specific strain of weird 80s epic blunder that you really just don't see anymore, for better and for worse, I think.
Right. The early to mid 80s were a weird time for cinematic high fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
Very weird. Lady Hawk.
I've not seen Lady Hawk. Actually, I haven't even seen Legend. I feel like a bit of a fraud. I just lumped it in with all these movies I have seen. So, mea culpa on that.
Legend is deeply strange. I only watched that relatively recently.
Okay.
Obviously, the thing Legend is known for is Tim Curry and all the makeup.
Sure. Is Tom Cruise the lead?
Yes.
Is that, okay, we've just been fucking rife with Tom Cruise references this episode.
I guess so.
A lot of the movie, not as much of it as you might expect, given the fact that the Nazis do kind of drop in and out, but a lot of the movie does turn into kind of the Holocaust kitsch. For lack of a better phrase, I mean, the liquidation of the villagers and then the subsequent attempted rape of Ava, it does feel a little bit She-Wolf of the SS at times. I mean, it's more highfalutin than that. I mean, that's as sleazy as it gets, as grindhouse as it gets. And this is not that. It's not pulpy fun the way that an Indiana Jones movie is, in the way that it deals with Nazis. I mean, it's a little grungier than that, a little more odious than that, in a way that I put it this way. The rape scene, attempted rape scene, is not meant to be titillating.
No.
But the soft core interlude in the village with the traveler from everywhere is meant to be titillating. And I was just looking at that thinking, like, why does this look like Baywatch when she was in Dachau 2 days ago? You know, it's like, I mean, she's in great shape. Her skin looks awesome.
She's remarkably well nourished.
Yeah, it's just camp. It's just like Holocaust camp, Holocaust kitsch. And that's a bitter pill to swallow. That's a lot to ask of an audience, I think. But that all, like everything else, that element kind of drops in and out, probably because the Nazis themselves drop in and out. It's not a prominent feature of the movie, because this movie almost cannot be said to have prominent features. The Keep itself is in almost every scene, almost every shot, and The Keep is cool looking, with the crucifixes in the wall glowing like kryptonite. But yeah, I mean, outside of the fact that Michael Mann is a master stylist, if it weren't for that, this movie would be just pure dreck, I'm willing to bet. Occasionally, yeah. The dialogue is all right, again, when you can hear it. So it's hard for me to go to bat for the screenplay, just due to the woeful condition of the mix.
Yeah, it's rough.
Every Michael Mann movie is worth watching, and I haven't seen all of them. I haven't seen a lot of his really early work, like L.A. Takedown, which was remade into Heat. I've seen Heat, obviously.
Right.
I haven't seen L.A. Takedown. There's, I think, one or two others. The Jericho Mile, is that a thing? I haven't seen The Jericho Mile.
He's got some...
It's a prison movie, is what I'm thinking of.
I haven't seen any of his TV movies.
Yes.
And that, you know, L.A. Takedown is one, and The Jericho Mile, if you have that right, and I think you do, that's another TV movie.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen all of his theatrical features.
I think I have also, as of tonight, seen all of his theatrical features.
Yeah, this was the last box to check for both of us.
Has he done anything since Black Hat?
No, he's had like a Ferrari movie in development for an eternity.
Okay.
And it hasn't gotten off the ground yet.
Well, in that case, I think I'm on pretty sure footing. Yeah, no, I mean, I all of his movies are worth watching. Fucking Black Hat is worth watching. If only because, like this movie, there's an absolutely glorious scene. In Black Hat, it's set on a speedboat. There's just this weirdly majestic scene set on a speedboat. There's like a Moby song blasting, because if it's not Tangerine Dream, you can bet your ass it's going to be Moby in a Michael Mann movie. And there's nothing to it. They're just getting from point A to point B, but there's something about it where Michael Mann just hits a groove, and for a minute, the movie is perfect, and then it goes back to being Black Hat. And, you know, it still has its charms, but it's mostly pretty disposable. But every once in a while, it just, that struck me. The only reason I'm bringing this up at all is because there's a good boat scene in The Keep that's also completely superfluous, but totally integral to the movie's appeal, weirdly.
Yeah, just based on the aesthetics.
Yeah, I mean, that's Michael Mann for you.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Ian McKellen, for what it's worth, does become more recognizably himself when he's squaring off with the golem right towards the very end. That scene gets very, you shall not pass.
Yeah, right, very...
Go back to the shadow! Dogfire will not avail you! Leave
you! Yeah, you know, it's very much that, so that's always good. That's always fun.
I mean, even there, he's striving for an American accent. It's just cracking. The facade is crumbling before your eyes.
The Nixon is dissolving.
I'm melting. Oh, what a world, what a world. Agnew, get those bums.
Well, that's Futurama.
Yes.
Right? Okay. We finally broke the Family Guy curse.
Well, you know, I had to.
Yeah.
Futurama is much more quotable anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know what my problem is. Even a movie where Ian McKellen is doing like some really terrible accent work, he's still pretty good.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard for an Ian McKellen performance to be truly bad or unsalvageable. Mm-hmm. And this is no exception. Most of the cast, like the main cast, is pretty good, despite the fact that we don't know what they're doing there.
Right. I think Gabriel Byrne gets upstaged a little bit. He's kind of, he doesn't have the same kind of commanding screen presence at that point in his career, I think, as the person that he's pitted against most often, Das Boot.
Yeah.
He just doesn't have the same gravitas. And his character is a little bit more of a pencil pusher, a little slimier. So maybe he wasn't meant to. But still, it feels like it's not like a heavyweight boxing match when they square off. It's like a heavyweight and a bantamweight.
Yeah. I would say the one weak link is the woman who plays Ava, Alberta Watson, I think her name is. I mean, she's mostly unobjectionable, but there's one scene in particular that I'm thinking of that her deliveries just land with a thud. It's shortly after the Cinemax scene where, I don't know, Scott Glenn is going off to do something, and she just starts, like, wailing about, like, why did you become my lover?
Oh, God, like, yeah, that was egregious.
Oof. And I mean, admittedly, there were some script issues there. Like, Mann didn't, because Michael Mann also wrote the screenplay for this movie.
Did he really?
He did.
It's based on a novel. I did not know that he was the sole screenwriter credit.
Yes.
The dialogue sounds like it came from a too many cooks situation, so I am a little appalled to learn that.
Right.
It sounds like there were way too many cooks in this kitchen.
I mean, it's entirely possible that there were a bunch of uncredited script changes.
Well, I'm sure that they had to change a bunch of stuff on the fly when they scrapped more than one ending and had to throw the back half of this movie together with just spit and metal.
Right. In any case, we only have one person to point to specifically for bad dialogue, and so it is Michael Mann's fault for giving her not great dialogue. but at the same time, she made it worse than it had to be.
Yeah, and well, and she's, as soon as I found out that the translator in Dachau had an attractive daughter, I figured, all right, she's going to be somebody's love interest and most likely is going to be sexually menaced by
Nazis.
The Nazis with the swastika armbands on, you know, the SS stooges. And sure enough, that's about the extent of her utility. I mean, she's there to have consensual sex and then be threatened with the prospect of the non-consensual variety. And it's pretty... that's about all there is to her, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, that line, there's no getting around it. That line is a total pile of shit on the page and on the screen. So, what to recommend? The Keep is, yeah, I mean, I rattled off a bunch of movies several minutes back, Dune and Company. All of those, Excalibur is too tangential even for me. That just, it just has the same vibe as this movie, although I think it's much better executed on the whole, but is still a mad, unrealizable dream of a maverick auteur who was operating with an inflated budget at a similarly strange point in the history of studio filmmaking. Like my co-host said, 80s was a weird time to be making high fantasy. So not Excalibur, not Dune, not any of those other kind of usual suspects that I lined up. I am instead going to recommend formally a different movie that I gave a shout out to some time ago, and that is Life Force, starring Sir Patrick Stewart in a supporting role as an asylum superintendent?
Yes.
What do you have? Asylum, I almost said principal. as the crusty dean of an asylum.
Puts the asylum on double secret probation.
Life Force is profoundly, massively, legendarily peculiar. It's a Tobe Hooper film from the mid-80s. I want to say 85.
Yes.
And it's about aliens?
Yeah.
You be the judge.
Vampire aliens.
Vampire alien succubi. Absolutely gorgeous woman, spends almost the entire movie nude. I don't remember the actress's name.
Matilda May.
Much less the character's name.
Doesn't have a name, I don't think.
Well, okay. Obviously, Tobe Hooper and Michael Mann are on the same page vis-a-vis female characters, at least at this point in their careers.
Hey, Ava had a name.
That's true. She had a name. Two names, actually.
Yeah, she had her father's last name. So, you know, hey, she was a real character.
Yeah, there you
Matilda May, on the other hand, is just a nude, buxom vampire lady.
Yeah, alien succubus. And she's entrancing. The whole movie is kind of hypnotic, and not just because, you know, I'm going like, aruga, aruga, like the cartoon wolf from a fucking Tex Avery cartoon.
Tex Avery, yeah.
It's all over the map. It turns into an exorcism movie at one point, and that's when Patrick Stewart comes into play. He has some demons driven out of him, if memory serves. It's a kind of classic lunatics are running the asylum sort of motif moment. And I can't even remember how that factors into the movie as a whole. It's just ludicrous. It's every bit as harebrained as Lynch's Dune or John Borman's Excalibur or Michael Mann's The Keep or, I assume, Ridley Scott's Legend. However, there's something just so soaringly absurd about Life Force. I don't know that it's a better movie than Excalibur. It almost certainly isn't, but it's the most entertaining, I think, of any of these big 80s follies that I've mentioned. It's probably the most low budget of all of them, but it's got the kind of grandeur. It feels like a huge misstep as you're watching it. It feels like everything went wrong, and yet I don't think I would change a frame of it. Our friend Ben has a really funny story about that movie, does he not?
I don't remember.
He told us in the before times that he remembered falling asleep on the couch watching movies with his dad and then waking up as when he was a young boy and thinking like, oh, my dad's watching porn, and then like pretending to be asleep. And then years later,
found out it was Life Force,
which, to be fair, is a movie in which this aforementioned woman is nude basically start to finish, head to toe. And so he like harbored that weird memory of like surreptitiously watching, you know, porn with his father, and then found out it was, you know, an honest to God movie of a kind.
Right.
And that was, you know, it was just like one of
it
those.
It wasn't just porn.
He just caught Life Force on TV and had this like Proustian rush of memory when it all came back to him. It was, his telling of it was very amusing. Anyway, go check out Life Force and obviously the Indiana Jones movies if you haven't already. The opening of the Ark of the Covenant is like a top five greatest scenes of all time across all genres as far as I'm concerned. It's almost without peer.
Yeah.
That line in Raiders actually kind of sums up the ethos of the keep rather well when Sala goes, "How? I don't know. I'm making it up as I go." Michael Mann responding to a lot of anxious letters from studio heads the same way.
"My special effects supervisor just died. I'm making it up as I go." I'm having trouble coming up with a recommendation, mostly because horror movies that are anchored around Nazis are almost exclusively schlock of the schlockiest grade.
Uh-huh.
They're like movies that put direct-to-DVD films to shame. I mean, they're also direct-to-DVD or nowadays to streaming or whatever.
Yeah.
But direct-to-video, just bad. There was one in particular I remember watching in high school. I reviewed it for the school newspaper, of all things. It was called Horrors of War. And it was just like, yeah, you know, Nazi scientists made zombies or some shit. They're almost exclusively terrible, and so it's hard to pick out a horror movie that involves Nazis in a central way that has something worth recommending.
Right. First Hellboy is okay, but that's only, like, horror-ish. I mean, it's horror-themed.
Well, yeah, and the Nazis are part of it.
Right.
But I wouldn't say it's a huge part.
You're right. My memory of it is rather fuzzy.
Yeah. Dead Snow is fun.
I haven't seen that.
I guess I would recommend Dead Snow. For those of you who don't know, it's a Norwegian film where basically these people who are on a ski trip run into these Nazi soldiers who were frozen under the snow and ice and emerged as zombies. It's a lot of gushy zombie fun. Obviously, one of our early maybe not obviously. Obviously, for longtime listeners to the podcast.
Yes, for the purists, for the stans.
One of our earliest episodes, I think, 6 was Overlord.
Oh yeah.
And that was good.
I enjoyed that movie more so than you'd think, given that I'd completely forgotten about it.
Right. And if it wasn't for the fact that, again, we're trying not to be Ouroboruses, I would just recommend Overlord over again. I feel a little bit better about it because it was so far back.
I mean, I benefited from that recommendation, apparently.
But yeah, for the most part, it's tough to pick out Nazi-adjacent horror films because most of them are just so bad, and I don't know why. They just are. It's just one of those things.
Yeah, I mean, Nazi bad guys lend themselves to, I don't know, there's just something outlandish about them. It's cartoon villainy in the real world, and therefore it can be difficult to do justice to without just making a cartoon, whether that's what you set out to do or not.
Right.
I mean, The Keep falls prey to that at various points. True. Although the cartoon German accent that I put on is not on not on display at any point. So,
no.
Don't let that bias you against the movie. It is, like any Michael Mann film, worth your time, but only 90-odd minutes of your time, maybe not 3.5 hours of it. Although I would hoover up the full-length version if it ever saw the light of day. I would even watch a version that was full of fucking storyboards and, like, set photography, like when they cobbled together the completed version of A Star is Born, the Judy Garland one. You know, like, TCM is always doing shit like that, mm-hmm. or, like, London After Midnight, lost Lon Chaney movie that now exists in a matter of speaking, because they got all the intertitles in order and then just filled it in with still frames. And I find this movie intriguing enough that I will continue to keep tabs on future versions of it should they come to light, but I don't expect any of them to be better than the one that I watched today. Just a different flavor of bad and weird.
Right. Well, I think that's all we have for The Keep. So,
yes, sir.
Until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from The Keep, 1983, trailer HD 1080p, uploaded by Horrorama Movie Trailers. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, November 22nd, and we'll be discussing McGee's horror comedy sequel, The Babysitter, Killer Queen. See you then.